Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Damian Barr, author of You Will Be Safe Here, his first novel, published in May by Bloomsbury. Damian is an award-winning writer and columnist. Maggie and Me, his memoir, won several prestigious awards. Damian writes columns for Big Issue and High Life. He's the creator and host of his own literary salon that premieres work from established and emerging writers. And as we talked about earlier, I'd love to talk to him for hours about that, but we're here to sell his books to be unpolished, but perhaps we can get into it. You know, sometimes I get a little nervous when a novel straddles two centuries with multiple characters, but no need to fear here. The pieces of this book fit together like a jigsaw puzzle. It may not be the most pleasant of juxtapositions, but it's a novel that immediately draws the reader in, not with certainty, but with a subtle questioning that leaves one a bit nervous and unsure, kind of one's own values. We explore and are pulled by the protagonist, Sarah van der Vaught, and her son Fred through their agonizing journey in 1901 during the Second Boer War, where the English established what were really the first true concentration camps. Sarah's diary describes in excruciating detail the nature of these camps. Fast forward to the 2000s, and we find ourselves in a different safe place, where young and different Willem is forced into another camp that differs in time and nature, but imposes the same torture and inhumanity that we have already explored. Lastly, the reader must come to acknowledge that the stories, both of them, are inspired not only by real events, but beckon us to realize that these events are still happening throughout the world, and some are even posted by our own nation. So with that perhaps too morbid introduction, welcome, Damian, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
So perhaps in beginning the story of your journey to this novel, tell us a little bit about the picture of the boy that you saw that seemed to provide the impetus for something that became so much more.
Well, I wasn't looking for a novel. I wasn't planning on writing a novel. I was just reading the newspaper, and I saw a picture of a boy. And this boy looked just like a boy who had come to my school in Scotland from South Africa in the 1980s. He'd been sent there by his family, and he turned up at this little school, and this is at the height of apartheid, and here was this white Afrikaner boy in our class. And at school, I didn't know exactly feel popular. I was definitely stuck out for being tall and skinny and lanky, and my parents had divorced, and I was gay, and that was obvious. And so I did not have an easy time at school, but here was this boy who was having an even harder time than I was. And we became friends, and we became very close, and he went back to South Africa after a year. And I never really heard from him again. We wrote a few letters, and we lost touch. It was before social media. And I hadn't seen him again until I saw this picture in the paper of this boy. And I realized it couldn't be him because, of course, he would be a man now, but it looked just like him. And this boy had been murdered really brutally in a camp that he'd been sent to by his mother and his stepfather, where he was told he would be safe, a camp that promised to make men out of boys. That was their slogan. What they actually made was corpses. But I, you know, became obsessed by what had happened to this boy, and I wanted to find out who he was, why he was sent to this place, who would send somebody to a place like that, and who ran a place like that, and why. And I just was following the trial online and eventually realized that I wanted to write something about it. I thought perhaps I would write some nonfiction or a piece of journalism. But in actual fact, you know, 5 years later, we have a novel.
Well, that begs the question of how did you decide that the other half of this story was going to be taking you back to the year 1900?
The camps that these boys are sent to, which still exist in South Africa and indeed around the world, as you mentioned in your introduction, there's a network of them, and people accept them. People think that it's all right to send their boys there. They're not camps for girls. There's no equivalent that I know of. But they think it's all right to send their boys there to toughen them up. And it's a hangover of a couple of different things. First of all, it's from national service, which was compulsory in South Africa until 1994 when Mandela was elected. And they had these brutal military camps for boys. And secondly, I had to look further, and deeper into, camps in South Africa and the memory of them. And the answer to these questions lies in 1900, during the Boer War, the British Empire descended with all its strength on these two fledgling states, who were fighting for freedom, an idea that was very attractive to Americans. Lots of Americans came and fought for the Boers and for the British, actually. The British were losing this war despite having superior numbers, and so they created a term we use all the time now, scorched earth. It's often used in relation to Donald Trump. But a scorched earth policy where they actually did scorch the earth. They came along, they killed all the animals on these farms, they threw the innards down the well to poison the water, and they ploughed salt into the soil, scorching it so that nothing would grow, and they created a homeless nation of women and children, and then they concentrated them into camps, which is how we have the expression concentration camp in English. And I realised that there was a national memory of the horror of these camps, which was being recreated and manifested in these new camps. And I should say that more women and children died in those camps in 1900 than soldiers died in the war. So we're talking about a national trauma that isn't really looked at in our history lessons in school, and hasn't really been looked at that much in fiction at all. And it seems really clear to me that, these contemporary camps were a manifestation of a past trauma that hadn't been explored, and I wanted to make what was to me quite the obvious link between the two and deal with them as one extended experience.
When you went back there, was Sarah waiting there for you along with Fred?
Do you know, that's so interesting. I made the names of the characters up. The voice was very clear. Sarah's voice was very, very clear. The first line of the novel has always been, the first line of the novel, and which is, we know they are coming. And she's on this farm looking out at this big expanse of flat veld. South Africa is a very beautiful country, and the geology, the topography is unique. And she can see these fires on the horizon, and it's the English torching these farms and getting closer and closer and closer. And I had this sense of what would it feel like to be like that, knowing that your husband was away fighting and it was just the staff and your vulnerable young son on this farm. How would that feel? And it's a complicated feeling as well, because Sarah is a reader. Her and Samuel read books. Samuel's the son of a pastor. She's the daughter of a farmer. And so she loves Dickens novels, which are hugely popular in this part of the world at this time. And she's a little bit excited in that way, because life on the farm is very steady. And she's ashamed about this tiny part of her that's excited. But most of her is afraid and is making these preparations for what is essentially an invasion. But so I made the names up. But then when I went to the Anglo-Boer War Museum, they had this big slab of black marble, which commemorates all the names of the women and children who died. And I just thought, well, I'll have a look. And there I found Sarah's name and Fred's name. And their names were real. The ages of the people were slightly different from my characters, but the names were right. And I felt such a strong sense of responsibility that somebody had to hear the stories of these women and children in this time. They had to be heard. They had to be told. And it's interesting in that regard, because my last book was a memoir, and I felt that same sense of compulsion when I was writing the book. I had to write the book. I had to tell that story, in that case, my story. But I felt like with the novel, I was having to tell their stories. It felt really urgent to me.
You know, I'll be jumping around a bit, but if you go back to the 2000s and the family you described there, I know that all families are dysfunctional, just in different ways, but Willem seems really off the charts. I mean, when you came up with the relationships of Raina and Irma and Jan and Rick, Elise, at first glance, seems to be the only normal one. And I'm just wondering how you created that family.
Well, I created it. I think all writers of fiction, you know, have their own experience to draw on. So, you know, my own family that I write about in Maggie and Me was very dysfunctional. It was a family where men were absent, but if they were present, they were largely violent. It was a culture of very toxic masculinity where the steelworks where everybody had been employed were closed. And so there was a lot of unemployment and a lot of unhappiness and a lot of inherited trauma, which was acted out again. So I have that experience, but, you know, I don't have to write about that. I don't have to use that. I could use any part of the rest of my life for this book. But when I went to South Africa and spent time there, and I went to spend time with the family of the boy who'd been murdered, Raymond Boyce, and I wrote a big article about that in The Guardian, you know, I was really struck by the similarities, actually, with my own childhood. Absent fathers, violent men, a culture of toxic masculinity, quite a lot of religion, and it felt familiar to me, actually. So, unbelievably, the characters in my novel actually have a happier time of it than many of the people that I met and spoke to in real life. But yeah, it's to anybody with any direct experience of abuse in their own family, wherever they are in the world, or anybody who's been and spent time in that particular part of South Africa, it will feel familiar to them. And actually, that's been one of the lovely things, is that readers have come to me and said, you know, this is their experience, this is their life, this has been the dynamics in their family, wherever they're from.
And then when you actually met the boy's mother, she seemed, and you've said this in the interviews, she seemed very forthcoming and kind and open to you, which is kind of surprising.
I mean, when she sent her son to that place, did it because she thought her son, Raymond, would be made better by it. She didn't send him there knowing he was going to be tortured and killed. I don't believe she's murderous. I believe she was lied to by her partner to a degree, and I believe that certainly the people who ran that place. Sorry, actually, I just want to retract that, what I said about her partner lying to her. I need to be really careful how I say that. I believe that she was misguided, and I believe that the people who ran the camp, certainly they lied to her about what they were doing. But equally, the people who ran the camp believed initially when they started it that they were doing a good thing. South Africa is a violent culture. White people are no longer guaranteed an easy ride just for being white. And they wanted to equip these boys for a difficult, tough world, and they think the way to do that is to toughen them up. And the boys who end up in these places are, you know, gay boys, goths, fat boys, a lot of boys with learning difficulties, some homeless boys. So, you know, these places are a kind of lost boys sort of space. But Wilna Boyce was very generous, and she opened her home to me, and she opened her heart to me, and she told me about the pain that she was in and the terrible guilt that she felt as a result of what happened to her son. And she'd been given a very, very hard time by the media. And I think it's really interesting that, you know, people blame the mother. They always blame the mother. Let's talk about the absent fathers, and let's talk about the men who actually inflicted the harm. And not just, you know, not just her role in it. But yeah, it was a privilege to be able to spend time with her, and it was heartbreaking because nothing I can say or write can bring her boy back. But what I wanted to do was dedicate the book to her son and to the women and children who died in 1900 to make people aware of what happened then and now. But I should say Willem, the character, the contemporary boy, is not Raymond. They're very, very, very different boys.
You know, when you mentioned Trump, I mean, I could go on for hours and rant about him, but...
It would not be good for your blood pressure. I don't want you having some kind of episode.
Well, unfortunately, I do it every day, so I have a very short shelf span. But when you portrayed the general, was the general an amalgam of people that you might have encountered in your life, or was a lot of it like when he raises his right fist in the courtroom, not to give any spoilers, but when he raises his right fist and he has all these supporters, it reminds me so much of, like, even last night Trump gave this rally in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and almost exactly the same thing happened.
And well, isn't it interesting that these men, through time, have the same characteristic, the same bombastic self-belief? There's no room for doubt. There is only certainty. There is only my certainty. There is only my truth. And that's what these men have. And that's very compelling, and it can be very attractive. And I really wanted to look at the general and understand him. I don't share his beliefs. I don't want what he wants for South Africa or for the world. But in order for that person to be believable and not just be a two-dimensional baddie, I had to really understand his fear. And that was my way into understanding. I think everybody has been afraid. We're all afraid of something. And I wanted to understand what were the general's fears. And that was my way into working out how he was able to justify to himself what he did. I basically sort of put my characters in therapy in that way. All of them, you know, because a lot of them hold beliefs that I, you know, a lot of them are racist or they're homophobic, they're misogynist, you know, but they are also, you know, people, and it's possible to be a good mother and be a racist. And that's an uncomfortable truth, but it's true to the child who doesn't understand that their mother holds these terrible beliefs. So I wanted to really explore that and understand that, but it was not a comfortable place for me as a writer, and certainly for readers. It forces you to confront your own beliefs and your own biases.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, the old saw about those who can hold two competing ideas in their head at the same time are either intelligent or sane. And it doesn't seem like there's that. Take abortion, for example. I mean, mm-hmm. In my mind, I can see both sides. I can listen to both sides and understand why they hold the beliefs that they do. But civilization seems to me to be a very thin veneer, kind of like creme brulee when you tap it with a spoon. And I don't know what it is. There's a tipping point, but I can't articulate it. Can you?
The tipping point that we're at just now.
Well, just now or pretty much any time in human history. There's a tipping point that, whether it's the Boer War or whether it's Cambodia or whether it's World War II or whether it's our immigration camps, which are concentration camps, and kids are dying in exactly the same way.
But it's when we stop thinking about people as people with their own stories and we start to tell a story about our people, that is the tipping point, right? So when all Jews are this, or when all immigrants are that, or when all gay people are this, as opposed to understanding that there are Jewish individuals, gay individuals, immigrant individuals, and that everybody has their own story, and that everybody needs to be free to pursue, you know, their own narrative, their own life. And dehumanizing people is the first step, as we understand it, to ending their lives. And what struck me about the Boer War was that here we have the British, you know, who are used to thinking of themselves as the global good guys, establishing this system of concentration camps where people who aren't soldiers are detained and punished and starved and abused and beaten, but all in the most polite way and all under the veneer of protection. This is good for you. We're taking care of you. We're feeding you. We're clothing you. All right, we burnt your farm in the first place, but that was your own fault because you decided that you wouldn't accept our rule. So, you know, you can see in that the Boer War the seeds of what is to happen later. And in fact, Hitler said he was inspired by the British in South Africa and also by the Americans and their treatment of First Nations people. So it's a really clear line from A to B to see, but I think what's interesting is the language and how the language changes. You know, the reason the book is called You Will Be Safe Here is because nobody ever says you won't be safe here, right? That's not how you get people into concentration camps. That's not how you get people in, you know, to acquiesce. You know, you tell people this is for your own safety, this is for the safety of others, and that's how those terrible things come to pass. Through euphemism and politeness and sort of Orwellian language and that's what we have to watch out for.
Yes, constantly. Like You know, this
constantly,
is...
yeah, constant vigilance. I'm afraid that's what's necessary. But right now, you know, our discourse has shifted and coarsened to such a degree that, you know, the language that's been used in the UK around betrayal of Brexit, you know, around immigrants, is a precursor to more serious and more sinister action. And we are at a tipping point. You know, I'm on book tour in America right now. I could go back to a country with a far right wing leader who wants to pull up the drawbridge on our little island and retreat to a non-existent past.
Yeah, and the problem now is, and maybe it's the first time, but I'm naive as well, but you have the United States Constitution, which is a very flexible document that I love. And it's so, once civility goes away, it's so hard to go back. And
right.
And that's where we are now. It will be so hard for us to go back. And
yes, how do you put the genie back in the bottle?
Exactly.
I had somebody describe it recently as, you know, taking apart a baked cake, trying to get all the different ingredients out. And I think that's an interesting way of looking at it. But we can get civility back if we understand the value of it, if we understand that it's, you know, that it's more than please and thank you, that it's about, you know, words are tools, they are weapons, they have a value, they have a power, and that we need to be really careful how we use them. And in your case, unfortunately, you know, your person at the very top of everything knows that, but appears not to know that, and that is the real danger. Because he's not, you know, your president is not, he is not without the necessary parts of his brains, that the animal cleverness that is required to abuse language. You know, he can do that. He's making those choices.
Okay, we're not talking about that anymore.
Sure, no, we won't. Sorry.
So, okay, switching gears completely. The scene in which Willem is, again, without spoiling anything, reaching his hand into this certain box. And
yeah.
I love the way he references the scene with the Bene Gesserit and Dune.
Yeah.
And, you know, I loved that box because, again, with uncertainty, I wondered and still wonder. So how do you think you would react to that box?
Oh, that's a difficult question. I mean, I would probably put my hand in. I don't know. This is a difficult thing in fiction, isn't it? Like, I have my characters do things that I wouldn't necessarily do myself. I don't know is the honest answer to that question.
Nor do I. It's like the classic one, you know, if there's a little girl in front of a speeding train and you can throw her out of the way, but you'll get hit by the train if you do. You don't know the answer. You think you know what you would do. Hopefully, the
well. This is the conundrum of fiction. You want people to be put in that position, and you want
exactly
to think about what they would do. And you know what we'd like to do and what we would do are different. And I think you don't know until you're in the position. But again, you know, there are actions that happen throughout the novel where people have to do things to survive. And I've felt like that in my own life before. You know, there've been things that I've had to do to survive that haven't necessarily made me proud. But I'm here, and so they've worked.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's go back to the book, because, again, that's what we're supposed to be talking about.
Sure.
If we go back to the book, and in that one live interview you did, which I was listening to as I was writing questions, you talk again about this idea that, and this is, here's the thing, and my brother gets mad at me for this, and I've said it many times. He likes books that at the end, they're put in a box, there's wrapping paper around them, and they're tied with a ribbon. And what you were saying in that interview is what you would like the reader to do is to work. And,
yeah.
And to wonder, okay, what would I do? What's going to happen next? As you said at the outset, whether that night in the, I'm not going to go into that.
Sure.
I don't want to spoil it. But whether they were doing something more than what, and then the reader wonders, were they? Did they?
Yeah.
You know, what happened? Yeah. Is he?
Yeah.
Why is that so important to you? It's important to me.
Because, I mean, your brother likes those books, and I like those books sometimes too, but that is not the book that I wanted to write, because I need something to pull me forward as a writer, which is, well, what's going to happen? You know, this book took 5 years, and part of the reason for that is because I was not always sure what was going to happen next. I didn't know until I got to know the characters and their world and do all that research and get all that context, you know, what was possible for them and what wasn't possible for them. So, you know, we know by the end of the book how certain events from the past have influenced the present, let's just say. We can reach some firm conclusions. As you say, the pieces of the jigsaw fit together. But, you know, for some people, the jigsaw is different. For some people, it's upside down. And for some people, it's incomplete. And that is life, right? That is life. We don't get, you know, every piece of the puzzle. It's not handed to us. There isn't always an image to tell us what it looks like, what we should be trying to do. And so in that respect, I wanted to show the characters across all these generations, you know, over 100 years, each with different bits of the puzzle, and each thinking, you know, that they have the answer, maybe, and not being sure. And some of them are right, and some of them aren't right. And,
right.
You know, that's just life.
Well, that's what was funny. At the end of the book, I thought, this just came unbidden into my head. When the general raises his right fist, I thought, you know, there's going to be some readers who agree totally.
Oh, absolutely.
And I thought, oh my God.
And well, this is the thing, you know, this is these people who, you know, like the general, you know, who is a total, you know, racist and who believes that these boys have to be toughened up and be, you know, to guard white South Africa's future so that the white South Africans aren't swept into the sea and the last white men in Africa don't end up the way that the others have gone. You know, he's certain of these beliefs and he really believes them. And yeah, I had to understand that, and yeah, you're right. I'm sure some people reading it would agree, but I want them to be challenged because of what I want to show is the impact of his beliefs on those boys, but also on himself. You know, we don't often think about the impact of violence on the person enacting the violence, and I wanted to show some of that in the book as well.
Well, the difference is you and I both understand him, whereas they're not interested in understanding us.
Yes.
So at first I thought these are going to be parallel stories and there's not going to be a time when we allow the characters to meet. So how did you decide, again without spoiling anything, that the museum trip was going to be the beginning of how the two stories began to weave themselves together?
Well, the book starts off with Sarah's diary, which is the longest part, and each part of the book gets progressively shorter.
Right.
And that was something I was thinking about because I wanted the structure to have an energy of its own, where you were propelled towards events, where there was a sense that you could not avoid these events. And the school trip is a really important scene because, you know, Willem is taken on a weekend school trip to the Anglo-Boer War Museum, where he's given an identity card as he arrives at the museum of somebody who was involved in that conflict. And he goes through the museum and discovers at the end what happened to that person. Now, that trip resolves some things for some of the characters from the earlier part of the novel and raises other questions about those characters. And I wanted to do that because it felt like a more satisfying, you know, kind of moment for the reader to go, oh, right, so that's what happened, and rather than to find it out, you know, in a continuation of Sarah's story, because we leave her at a very critical point. And I wanted the reader to be left at that point and to be thinking, you know, what happened, and for that to sort of haunt them until they get some of the answers from later on. But the book is full of resonances and echoes, the landscape, some of the language, there's a recurring song, a melody. And that is because when I was doing my research, you know, these motifs would recur. For example, the Southern Cross, which is the constellation that you see in the Southern Hemisphere, you know, you could not live in that country under those stars and not be affected by those stars. So those stars become like a meme for all the characters in the novel, and as they were for me you know, as the writer.
It's interesting how many things are resonant in the book from things we learned as a child. Like, it's so hard to do this without giving things away. But the woman in the house, it's like the woman in the gingerbread house.
Yes.
In the fairy tale. And then the other thing is the comparison to holes. And it's actually a comparison in two separate ways. And that was something that I didn't, one, expect, but two, especially at the end and what was there, was, and I think that was the epiphany of the book. Particularly, I think that was the epiphany of the book.
It's really interesting that you say that, because I, you know, it was only really when I finished the first draft a couple of years back that I myself made the connection with holes. And then I was like, oh, this is, there's a massive, you know, similarity that these boys who love books would be aware of. Not for the other characters and not necessarily for the general reader, but for the boys, certainly Willem, his bookish, would be aware of. And so that's when I had to think about how I would deal with that in the text. Because the last thing I want is for the reader to kind of have a question raised or a flag raised and for it to get in the way of their understanding of the story. So that's why I made that consciously, that point consciously.
Yeah, and again, for the reader, first of all, the reader has to not be smart enough, but the reader has to have read the book. And then when you read the book, you think, okay, well, this could never happen. And then you look at what happens, and this is exactly what happens.
Yeah.
So you take it from this kind of speculative fiction into the real world, not only in a contemporary sense, but again, back in 1900 as well, the same type of activity. And that's when you begin to, that's when you begin to do what you want to do. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and if we think about where this book ends as well, you know, I could draw a line which, you know, is a graph which would continue in a particular direction for some of those characters. You know, it's, their lives continue, these patterns continue, and some of them continue to behave the same way, and others of them are transformed completely by what they've been through. And their lives are very different, for better and for worse, you know.
Yeah. And then what also gives rise is that you and I both know what's happening in Yemen, you and I both know what's happening in Syria, and yet neither of us, well, I don't know, at least me, I don't really do anything about it. You know, I try to think, what is it I could do about it? But that's one of the that's one of the great, perhaps insurmountable problems, is when the world tilts that way.
But reading though, is a radical act. Reading a book like this, I mean, choosing to read a book which takes you to difficult places, you know, whether you're talking about, you know, The Handmaid's Tale or The Color Purple or Underground Railway or whatever it is, you know, you pick up a book and you choose to deal with stuff that is difficult, stuff that is painful, that you could just look away from, right? You could just ignore it. That is an act of radical empathy. It's a very old, fundamentally human thing to witness. Sarah Perry talks about this in her brilliant novel, Melmoth, and I've talked about this with Sarah, the idea of witness, the idea of bearing witness, of testimony. And that is something that we can do to acknowledge and honour the suffering of people who have gone before, but also to make us aware of the danger signs, of the triggers, of the things that we have to watch out for, so that we can stop it happening again, or not be complicit in it. And quite genuinely, you know, I have heard from readers who didn't know that, you know, that these camps still existed, and who are, you know, who maybe are from a family where people have been sent there or could be sent there. And if, you know, this book stops one boy in South Africa being sent to one of these places, if it makes one mother aware of what they're really like, then that, to me, will be the greatest success. But, you know, we have to read the book to understand our history in order to not repeat it.
You know, so as we get towards the end of this, I'm always interested in two things, the epigraph or epigraphs and the cover of the book. The epigraphs because, again, going back to the jigsaw motif, it's like the cover of the box. And You have three epigraphs, each of them completely different in meaning and tone. Mm-hmm. And you must have thought a great deal about not only one, but how you would combine the three. And it does give rise, again, to an initial thought process that, wait a minute, what is this country? What is it?
Yeah.
So how did you do that?
Well, I mean, I actually, initially, I had about 10 quotes, which I went back to again and again when I was writing the book, because I found that they made, you know, for example, the quote from Mandela, which is the epigram at the beginning where he says, I'm just going to open the book, he says, never, never, and never again shall it be that this beautiful land will again experience the oppression of one by another. And to me, that just, you know, the power of that man who'd been in prison and led to the new South Africa, you know, he really believed that, he really wanted that, and that's really not what's happening there. And to me, that spoke of hubris, and I wanted to explore that, how the best intentions are frustrated. And then the other quote is from Kutsaya in The Heart of the Country, and he says, truly events have a power to move unmatched by one's darkest imaginings. And that still makes me shiver reading it, you know.
Right.
Because the characters in this novel very often aren't aware of just how bad things can get, and they think they've got as bad as they can get, and then they get worse. And that's because I think we don't suspect, because people say you will be safe here. You know, we have these expectations that, you know, people aren't necessarily going to tell us the truth. And so I just wanted to show that. And that, you know, that's a very troubling novel, his novel. And then the quote at the end from Rian Malan, he says, there's no such thing as a true story here. The facts may be correct, but the truth they embody is always a lie to somebody else. Every inch of our soil is contested, every word in our histories. So what I want immediately to do is to make the reader think, you know, who's telling the truth here? And what truth? And why are they telling it? And what do they really want me to believe? And where is the space, just to come back to this idea of doubt, where is the space between what they believe and what is true? And that's where we find meaning, and that's where we find nuance and all these things that we're so desperately in need of right now as a culture.
Yes, and it's the third one that, if anything, telegraphs what will happen. Well, there's two things. One, it gives you a feeling of horror to a certain extent. Mm. It gives you an idea of what's to come. And third, now that I've researched a bit about you and listened to that interview, it kind of is the emblem of what you're trying to do when you write.
Yes. Yes, you're absolutely right. And I can't imagine that I'm ever not going to be preoccupied by these questions of truth and meaning and who gets to say what is true and who gets to say what is not true. And I know where it comes from. I mean, I know where it comes from.
Sure.
You know, it comes from my childhood. It comes from having grown up in a house where, you know, when I was beaten or abused, I was told nobody would believe me. Nobody would believe that I was telling the truth. And it was extremely empowering for me to write a memoir and to tell that truth rather than to tell it as a fiction. But what I realized with the novel is that I can tell a different truth through fiction than I can through memoir. And that's, you know, that's what's been dazzling to me as a writer, more so than as a reader, actually.
The other thing is, I own an independent bookstore, so...
I know you do.
And your book is on the front table. And as many times as I hear, you can't judge a book by its cover, every single person who, every single, without exception, unless they know what they're looking for, who comes in there judges the book initially by its cover. I do the same thing. And so, one, it's a great cover. And, you know, again, from listening to you, it combines both stories. But did you get to vet it? Did you love it when you saw it? How did it work out?
So, I mean, authors, I think people think they have much more power over the process of publishing than they do. But actually, in this instance, I did get to see it. And the US cover is a variation of the UK cover. They're both very typographic. I love typographic covers. And they're both very strong. You know, this is, as you say, you can judge this book by its cover. And maybe that scares some people away, I don't know. But, you know, it has the color orange in it, which is to do with the color of the soil in that part of South Africa and the Orange Free State. And it has this, you know, it's telling you a lie right on the cover. You will be safe here. The characters aren't, the reader isn't, and you make a choice to go in there. You have the choice. The characters don't, but you have the choice, and that, I think, makes the reader brave and noble and good. But I love this jacket. I was really keen to avoid the cliches that I see in publishing of African novels,
right.
You know, which look like a tourist brochure and invariably simplify and I think patronise the people and cultures that they're supposed to depict. So I think Bloomsbury have got this right. They're very good at covers, and I'm really impressed by this. I like the shadow of the tree, and I like the way when you fold it out, you see this tree. And I don't know what the paperback will be like. We're talking about it now. I have no idea, but I think it's a really handsome book.
It's interesting because the publishers know exactly what they're doing, and they're really smart. And the authors, sorry, aren't. And
no, it's not my forte at all. I'm not visual, and I'm also colorblind. So when it came through, I had no idea what color it was, and I had to ask my husband what color it was. I was like, "Is it red? Is it purple? What is that color?" And he explained it to me. So it's certainly not what I would have done, but that's why it's good.
So lastly, because you said you'd be willing to do it.
Sure.
Again, because I have a bookstore, and I've always dreamed of having this salon. And the other thing is that I've dreamed of what you said, is that you're not trying to sell books. Well, the authors there, you're not standing in line signing. You're not required to buy the book and enter.
Nope.
It's just,
in fact, there are no books.
Right, exactly. And so you just go in, and everyone's entitled to say what they want to say. And it's something that doesn't, and especially since it's at the Savoy. I mean, so talk, you know, just give me a minute or two to tell me what that's like for my own edification.
The salon started 10 years ago. I started it at Shoreditch House, which is a private members club, and I wanted a book event basically where my friends could come along and relax and be sociable about books, because books are such an important part of all of our lives, but we felt like you had to go into a very austere literary space where you stroked your chin and nodded knowingly about everything, and then we're under a great deal of pressure to buy the book at the end. And what I wanted to do was create a space where writers could come along and just talk honestly and openly in a way where they don't have to sell the book, where they can talk as much about themselves as about the story that they're there to talk about, because there's such an interesting relationship between the author and their work. And they know that, you know, they're not going to be sitting at a little table at the end. Now, the salon shifts books. We know that lots and lots of booksellers and book buyers come, and agents and publishers and all of that sort of stuff. But it's really an audience of book lovers, and people can listen if they want to the salon. It's a podcast on iTunes, and it's on planes, it's on British Airways, it's in lots of different places. But it's three writers, they come along, they read from new work, sometimes it's unfinished. So Maggie O'Farrell, Jojo Moyes, David Nichols have all, you know, premiered their last few novels there. Recently we've had Rose McGowan, Diana Attell, the great editor and writer, made one of her last appearances there. Lots of American writers, Yaa Gyasi, John Waters, Brittany Spinellis. So, you know, we get a mixture of established and emerging names, and they read for about 10 minutes, and then I interview them, and I ask them what I like. and they love it, and the audience is very engaged. It's a really brilliant community of book buyers, and some writers too, but, you know, readers. And it's just a luxury for me, because I get to spend time with the best writers in the world, and it's just like this ongoing creative writing class. And I feel it's a privilege to do it, and it started off as a hobby, and it's now my life. There's a big team of us, and we've been all around the world. We've been to New York, we've been to Sydney, Moscow, Istanbul, everywhere. And everywhere we go, you know, there are people who love books and stories and want to be part of that conversation.
It sounds like Christmas Day to me.
Well, you must come sometime.
I would love to. I will come. But it's funny because
that's a very lovely thought. Where are we next in America? I don't know. We might be doing one in America in November. But there's one on a boat. We're doing one on the Queen Mary. We're going from New York to London, and we're doing one over the course of a week on a boat there. So that'll be fun.
Here's what's going to happen with you and me. The first time I interviewed Jojo Moyes, I had all the time in the world. We just did like we're doing now. We've been talking for 50 minutes. But the second time, she was so popular that her publicist was on the line, and 15 minutes in, she goes, "That's it. Got to go. Hard out." That's what's going to happen the next time.
Wonderful. That's not what's going to happen with us. No, because, and that would not have been Jojo's choice, actually. Jojo is a great talker, and she's very, very generous with her time. And she has a new book out soon, The Giver of Stars, it's called. It's all about women librarians on horseback in the Midwest. Very American book.
I'll see if I can.
But no, you will not be cut off by my publicist after 15 minutes the next time we talk.
Well, I'm going to try to do the same thing you did. The other thing I think about the bookstore, even though I'm talking more than you, is that when young readers especially come in and they're looking for a book and they climb my library ladder, they see the
book. Library ladder? That's the loveliest thing in the world. That's
I know. I dreamt of it all my life. I have two. And I'm thinking, well, this is kind of dangerous, but I can't not let them climb it. So,
of course you can.
So anyway, they're looking for a book. They see it, but they also, as you know, see the book on either side of it. And one of those may be the book that changes their lives. And that reminds me of the salon a bit. And so I'll try and do it. One time we did have a meeting of all the best customers, those who we liked the best, who actually, you know, in a Machiavellian sense, spent the most money. But it was a great meeting because when someone asked a question, one of us would know the answer. And I imagine that's what happens at yours.
Yeah, no, that's very true. They're the most well-read audience, I think, at any event. And that's why authors love doing it, because they know they're never going to get the "where do you get your ideas, do you write with a pen or a pencil" question. Or similarly, "this is not a question, it's more of a comment. I don't allow that." And, you know, that it wouldn't happen in that room. But we have a huge range of people in that audience, you know, from 18 to 80, I don't know. It's a range. We have a really diverse audience, and I'm very proud of that, actually. It's very important to me. Because it looks at the Savoy, it's not intimidating, you know, to arrive there. It's a very lovely place, but like all truly posh places, it makes everybody feel special, not snobby. And it has brilliant stories attached to it. I mean, it's where Oscar Wilde feasted with panthers. H.G. Wells, one of the founders of Penn, you know, he had lots of book launches and parties there. It's been literary for a long time. So we are just the latest literary incarnation, and we've started a writer-in-residence scheme there, so writers get to come and stay in the hotel for a month. Can you imagine the joy of that? So they get to come stay for a month, and they write a short story. We've got we had Sarah Perry there recently. We've got Garth Greenwell coming up. Aminata Forna will be a writer-in-residence as well. So
you would actually let me in?
Of course you would be let in. This is the thing, you know. It's a very welcoming audience.
Do I have to wear a morning suit?
You don't need a morning suit. I mean, people, we draw the line at people turning up in bikinis, although there is a pool. We've yet to have a literary pool party. But no, I mean, some people super dress up and other people just walk up in their after work clothes, and everybody's treated the same. And there's no green room. The authors are there in the room. You know, I remember once when Armistead Maupin did it, I overheard somebody saying excitedly in the audience, "I just took a pee next to Armistead Maupin." And they were just so completely thrilled by it. I'm not sure how thrilled Armistead was. But it's a very open space, because I want people to realize that writers are just people, you know. We're people doing a job, and to humanize that process and make writing more accessible. I grew up not knowing writers. I grew up not owning books, and I want to break down those barriers. I've just published an essay in a collection called Common People, which you should check out, which is all about working class writers and working class voices, and that's a really big issue in the UK right now. And you know, we you know, all people who program literary events have to be really conscious of class as an aspect of identity,
I would
so
say,
that we can do our bit to make it accessible.
I would say that is so cool, but from reading your book, I'm not supposed to say it's so cool anymore. So I have to avoid that. That bothered me too. I'm thinking, I say that all the time. In any event, Damien, I didn't want to take up your whole day, but...
No, at all. I've really enjoyed talking to you. It's been really lovely, actually. Can I just ask a couple of quick questions about your shop?
Yep,
Are you open every day?
We are open every day from 9:30 to 7. A little bit shorter hours on the weekends. And
are you in there every day?
I'm there every day.
Oh, so you get to know all your customers.
Yes, except I'm horrible with names, but I have this one excellent colleague who whispers the name as the people come in.
Oh, that's very good.
Yes, it is.
And what's your best-selling book right now? What's the book that people just can't get enough of?
Well, there's several of them.
Okay.
I'm trying to think of what would be the best one. You've got me now. I can't. I'm horrible.
You can't remember
this.
Any of the titles. You could probably visualize them, but you can't remember any of them.
Well, I'll tell you, the best-selling books in the past 5 years have been Rules of Civility and Gentlemen in Moscow.
That's so interesting. So Amor was a guest at my salon. We premiered the second book, the Moscow book, at Savoy. We did a book all about hotels at a hotel, and it gave it a whole extra layer of meaning. So he's great.
He's such an intelligent, engaging person, and I had a long talk with him at the Philadelphia Library. And yeah. He didn't even want to do this. This wasn't what his life was about.
No, he worked in Wall Street, didn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah, he was like a hedge fund or something like that. Yeah.
No, he's a delightful, he's a true gentleman, actually. He's a great man. I'm looking forward to seeing what he writes next. And I actually don't know what he's working on just now. I must try and find that out. His editor is a friend of mine. I'll ask her. But yeah, those are two good books.
The problem is that even though I have a very high socioeconomic demographic in my area, no one wants to pay $29.95, and it took so long for both of those books to come out in paperback that it was difficult to, you know, I'd have to come out from behind the counter and say, read this, if you don't like it, bring it back.
Do people ever do that?
No.
So you can bring it back, they don't. That's a very good tactic. Well, thank you very much for your time today. I really do appreciate it. It's been really lovely to talk properly with you about the book.
I agree.
And I hope that it does well for you in the shop.
I'm sure it will. And then perhaps I'll see you on the Queen Mary.
Yeah, well, that would be lovely.
Okay.
Ahoy, then, in that case.
Thanks so much, Damien. So... Damien Barr, You Will Be Safe Here. It's a wonderful book. You could tell from the way we were talking together that there was definitely a connection. I'm kind of bragging. He has this wonderful salon which people just come and talk about books. It's wonderful. So if you're ever in London and want to go to the salon, it's at the Savoy Hotel, which has an enormous history. The book is really good because it does make you question our society today, and you guys know how I feel about what's happening in our society today. But that's a tangent. So join us every week, if you can, for more insightful and engaging discussions with today's, including Damien, and other compelling authors. So what we have coming up, and this is just a couple, is Catherine Eben, who's going to discuss her fascinating new book, which is really yipes, you didn't know this. It's called Bottle of Lies, The Inside Story of the Generic Drug Boom. It's all about generic drugs and the nasty things that are put into them and the haphazard way in which they're created. And then Julie Oranger will join us to discuss, and Rebecca does this, one of the most anticipated novels of 2019, The Flight Portfolio. So, for a complete schedule, you can always visit us at our website, wellingtonsquarebooks.com, or simply download our podcast at Podomatic or at iTunes. So, thanks as always. We really appreciate you being here to listen, and we hope you'll come back next week to hear another discussion on The Avid Reader.